Paul felt a burst of anger. The man who had befriended them, helped save them from the Harkonnen hunters, the man who had sent his Fremen cohorts searching for two strays in the desert, another victim of the Harkonnens. "Does Ussul hunger yet for revenge?" Farouk asked. Before Paul could answer, there came a low call, and the troop swept forward into a wider chamber, carrying Paul with them. He found himself in an open space, confronted by Stilgar and a strange woman wearing a flowing, wrap-around garment of brilliant orange and green. Her arms were bare to the shoulders, and he could see she wore no stillsuit. Her skin was a pale olive. Dark hair swept back from her high forehead, throwing emphasis on sharp cheekbones and aquiline nose between the dense darkness of her eyes. She turned toward him, and Paul saw golden rings threaded with water tallies dangling from her ears.
"This bested my gems?" she demanded.
"Be silent, Hera," Stilgar said. "It was Jamis's doing. He invoked the Tahadi al-Burhan."
"He's not but a boy," she said.
She gave her head a sharp shake from side to side, setting the water tallies to jingling.
"My children made fatherless by another child? Surely, 'twas an accident."
"Ussul, how many years have you?" Stilgar asked.
15 standard," Paul said.
Stilgar swept his eyes over the troop.
"Is there one among you cares to challenge me?"
Silence. Stilgar looked at the woman.
"Until I've learned his weirding ways, I'd not challenge him."
She returned his stare.
"But
you saw the stranger woman who went with Cheney to the Reverend Mother?" Stilgar asked. "She's an Outfrain Sayadina, mother to this lad. The mother and son are masters of the weirding ways of battle."
"Liza Nalgaib," the woman whispered.
Her eyes held awe as she turned them back toward Paul. The legend again, Paul thought.
"Perhaps," Stilgar said. "It hasn't been tested, though."
He returned his attention to Paul.
"Ussul, it's our way that you've now the responsibility for Jamis's woman here and for his two sons. His Yali, his quarters are yours, his coffee service is yours. And this, his woman."
Paul studied the woman, wondering, "Why isn't she mourning her man? Why does she show no hate for me?" Abruptly, he saw that the Fremen were staring at him, waiting. Someone whispered,
"There's work to do. Say how you accept her."
Stilgar said,
"Do you accept Hera as woman or servant?"
Hera lifted her arms, turning slowly on one heel.
"I am still young, Ussul. It said I still look as young as when I was with Jeff, before Jamis bested him."
Jamis killed another to win her, Paul thought. Paul said,
"If I accept her as servant, may I yet change my mind at a later time?"
"You'd have a year to change your decision," Stilgar said. "After that, she's a free woman to choose as she wishes, or you could free her to choose for herself at any time. But she's your responsibility, no matter what, for 1 year, and you'll always share some responsibility for the sons of Jamis."
"I accept her as servant," Paul said.
Hera stamped a foot, shook her shoulders with anger.
"But I'm young!"
Stilgar looked at Paul, said,
"Caution's a worthy trait in a man who'd lead."
"But I'm young," Hera repeated.
"Be silent," Stilgar commanded. "If a thing has merit, it'll be. Show Ussul to his quarters and see he has fresh clothing and a place to rest."
"Oh!"
she said. Paul had registered enough of her to have a first approximation. He felt the impatience of the troop, knew many things were being delayed here. He wondered if he dared ask the whereabouts of his mother and Cheney, saw from Stilgar's nervous stance that it would be a mistake. He faced Hera, pitched his voice with tone and tremolo to accent her fear and awe, said,
"Show me my quarters, Hera. We will discuss your youth another time."
She backed away 2 steps. Cast a frightened glance at Stilgar.
"He has the weirding voice," she husked.
"Stilgar," Paul said, "Cheney's father put heavy obligation on me. If there's anything..." "It'll be decided in council," Stilgar said. "You can speak then."
He nodded in dismissal, turned away with the rest of the troop following him. Paul took Hera's arm, noting how cool her flesh seemed, feeling her tremble.
"I'll not harm you, Hera," he said. "Show me our quarters."
And he smoothed his voice with relaxance.
"You'll not cast me out when the year's gone," she said. "I know for true I'm not as young as once I was."
"As long as I live, you'll have a place with me," he said.
He released her arm.
"Come now, where are our quarters?"
She turned, led the way down the passage, turned right into a wide cross tunnel lighted by evenly spaced yellow overhead globes. The stone floor was smooth, swept clean of sand. Paul moved up beside her, studied the aquiline profile as they walked.
"You do not hate me, Hera?"
"Why should I hate you?"
She nodded to a cluster of children who stared at them from the raised ledge of a side passage. Paul glimpsed adult shapes behind the children, partly hidden by filmy hangings.
"I bested Jameis.
Stilgar said the ceremony was held, and you're a friend of Jameis."
She glanced sidelong at him.
"Stilgar said you gave moisture to the dead. Is that truth?"
"Yes."
"It's more than I'll do. Can do."
"Don't you mourn him?"
"In the time of mourning, I'll mourn him."
They passed an arched opening. Paul looked through it at men and women working with stand-mounted machinery in a large, bright chamber. There seemed an extra tempo of urgency to them.
"What are they doing in there?" Paul asked.
She glanced back as they passed beyond the arch, said,
"They hurry to finish the quota in the plastics shop before we flee. We need many dew collectors for the planting."
"Flee?"
"Until the butchers stop hunting us, or are driven from our land."
Paul caught himself in a stumble, sensing an arrested instant of time, remembering a fragment, a visual projection of prescience, but it was displaced like a montage in motion. The bits of his prescient memory were not quite as he remembered them.
"The Saduka hunt us," he said.
"They'll not find much excepting an empty sietch or two," she said, "and they'll find their share of death in the sand."
"They'll find this place?" he asked.
"Likely."
"Yet we take the time to."
He motioned with his head toward the arch now far behind them.
"Make dew collectors?"
"The planting goes on."
"What are dew collectors?" he asked.
The glance she turned on him was full of surprise.
"Don't they teach you anything in the... wherever it is you come from?"
"Not about dew collectors."
"Hi,"
she said, and there was a whole conversation in the one word.
"Well, what are they?"
"Each bush, each weed you see out there in the erg," she said. "How do you suppose it lives when we leave it? Each is planted most tenderly in its own little pit. The pits are filled with smooth ovals of chromoplastic. Light turns them white. You can see them glistening in the dawn if you look down from a high place. White reflects. But when Old Father Sun departs, the chromoplastic reverts to transparency in the dark. It cools with extreme rapidity. The surface condenses moisture out of the air. That moisture trickles down to keep our plants alive."
"Dew collectors," he muttered, enchanted by the simple beauty of such a scheme.
"I'll mourn Jameis in the proper time for it," she said, as though her mind had not left his other question. "He was a good man, Jameis, but quick to anger. A good provider, Jameis, and a wonder with the children. He made no separation between Jeff's boy, my firstborn, and his own true son. They were equal in his eyes."
She turned a questing stare on Paul.
"Would it be that way with you, Ursul?"
"We don't have that problem."
"But if—"
"Hera!"
She recoiled at the harsh edge in his voice. They passed another brightly lighted room visible through an arch on their left.
"What's made there?" he asked.
"They repair the weaving machinery," she said, "but it must be dismantled by tonight."
She gestured at a tunnel branching to their left.
"Through there and beyond, that's food processing and still suit maintenance."
She looked at Paul.
"Your suit looks new. But if it needs work, I'm good with suits. I work in the factory in season."
They began coming on knots of people now and thicker clusterings of openings in the tunnel's sides. A file of men and women passed them, carrying packs that gurgled heavily, the smell of spice strong about them.
"They'll not get our water," Hera said, "or our spice. You can be sure of that."
Paul glanced at the openings in the tunnel walls, seeing the heavy carpets on the raised ledge, glimpses of rooms with bright fabrics on the walls, piled cushions. People in the openings fell silent at their approach, followed Paul with untamed stares.
"The people find it strange you bested Jameis," Hera said. "Likely you'll have some proving to do when we're settled in a new siege."
"I don't like killing," he said.
"Thus Stilgar tells it," she said, but her voice betrayed her disbelief.
A shrill chanting grew louder ahead of them. They came to another side opening, wider than any of the others Paul had seen. He slowed his pace, staring in at a room crowded with children sitting cross-legged on a maroon-carpeted floor. At a chalkboard against the far wall stood a woman in a yellow wraparound, a projecto stylus in one hand. The board was filled with designs, circles, wedges and curves, snake tracks and squares, flowing arcs split by parallel lines. The woman pointed to the designs one after the other as fast as she could move the stylus, and the children chanted in rhythm with her moving hand. Paul listened, hearing the voices grow dimmer behind as he moved deeper into the siege with Hera.
"Tree," the children chanted. "Tree, grass, dune, wind, mountain, hill, fire, lightning, rock, rocks, dust, sand, heat, shelter, heat, full, winter, cold, empty, erosion, summer, cavern, day, tension, moon, night, caprock, sand tide, slope, planting, binder."
"You conduct classes at a time like this?" Paul asked. Her face went somber and grief edged her voice.
"What Liet taught us, we cannot pause an instant in that. Liet, who is dead, must not be forgotten. It's the Chakobsa way."
She crossed the tunnel to the left, stepped up onto a ledge, parted gauzy orange hangings and stood aside.
"Your Yali is ready for you, Usul."
Paul hesitated before joining her on the ledge. He felt a sudden reluctance to be alone with this woman. It came to him that he was surrounded by a way of life that could only be understood by postulating an ecology of ideas and values. He felt that this Fremen world was fishing for him, trying to snare him in its ways. And he knew what lay in that snare. The wild jihad, the religious war he felt he should avoid at any cost.
"This is your Yali," Hera said. "Why do you hesitate?"
Paul nodded, joined her on the ledge. He lifted the hangings across from her, feeling metal fibres in the fabric, followed her into a short entranceway and then into a larger room, square, about 6 meters to a side, thick blue carpets on the floor, blue and green fabrics hiding the rock walls. Glow globes tuned to yellow overhead, bobbing against draped yellow ceiling fabrics. The effect was that of an ancient tent. Hera stood in front of him, left hand on hip, her eyes studying his face.
"The children are with a friend," she said. "They will present themselves later."
Paul masked his unease beneath a quick scanning of the room. Thin hangings to the right, he saw, partly concealed a larger room with cushions piled around the walls. He felt a soft breeze from an air duct, saw the outlet cunningly hidden in a pattern of hangings directly ahead of him.
"Do you wish me to help you remove your stillsuit?" Hera asked.
"No, thank you."
"Shall I bring food?"
"Yes."
"There is a reclamation chamber off the other room," she gestured, "for your comfort and convenience when you're out of your stillsuit."
"You said we have to leave this siege," Paul said. "Shouldn't we be packing or something?"
"It will be done in its time," she said. "The butchers have yet to penetrate to our region."
Still she hesitated, staring at him.
"What is it?" he demanded.
"You've not the eyes of the Ibad," she said. "It's strange, but not entirely unattractive."
"Get the food," he said. "I'm hungry."
She smiled at him. a knowing woman's smile that he found disquieting.
"I am your servant,"
she said, and whirled away in one lithe motion, ducking behind a heavy wall hanging that revealed another passage before falling back into place. Feeling angry with himself, Paul brushed through the thin hanging on the right and into the larger room. He stood there a moment, caught by uncertainty, and he wondered where Chaney was. Chaney, who had just lost her father. "We're alike in that," he thought. A wailing cry sounded from the outer corridors, its volume muffled by the intervening hangings. It was repeated, a bit more distant. And again. Paul realized someone was calling the time. He focused on the fact that he had seen no clocks. The faint smell of burning creosote bush came to his nostrils, riding on the omnipresent stink of the siege. Paul saw that he had already suppressed the odorous assault on his senses. And he wondered again about his mother, how the moving montage of the future would incorporate her, and the daughter she bore. Mutable time awareness danced around him. He shook his head sharply, focusing his attention on the evidences that spoke of profound depth and breadth in this Fremen culture that had swallowed him, with its subtle oddities. He had seen a thing about the caverns and this room, a thing that suggested far greater differences than anything he had yet encountered. There was no sign of a poison snooper here, no indication of their use anywhere in the cave warren. Yet he could smell poisons in the siege stench. Strong ones. Common ones. He heard a rustle of hangings, thought it was Hera returning with food, and turned to watch her. Instead, from beneath a displaced pattern of hangings, he saw two young boys, perhaps aged 9 and 10, staring out at him with greedy eyes. Each wore a small kinjal type of kriss knife, rested a hand on the hilt. And Paul recalled the stories of the Fremen, that their children fought as ferociously as the adults.
The hands move, the lips move, ideas gush from his words, and his eyes devour. He is an island of selfdom. Description from Emmanuel of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
Phosphor tubes in the faraway upper reaches of the cavern cast a dim light onto the thronged interior, hinting at the great size of this rock-enclosed space. Larger, Jessica saw, than even the gathering hall of her Bene Gesserit school. She estimated there were more than 5,000 people gathered out there beneath the ledge where she stood with Stilgar. And more were coming. The air was murmurous with people.
"Your son has been summoned from his rest, Sayadina," Stilgar said. "Do you wish him to share in your decision?"
"Could he change my decision?"
"Certainly. The air with which you speak comes from your own lungs, but—"
"The decision stands," she said.
But she felt misgivings, wondering if she should use Paul as an excuse for backing out of a dangerous course. There was an unborn daughter to think of as well. What endangered the flesh of the mother endangered the flesh of the daughter. Men came with rolled carpets, grunting under the weight of them, stirring up dust as the loads were dropped onto the ledge. Stilgar took her arm, led her back into the acoustical horn that formed the rear limits of the ledge. He indicated a rock bench within the horn.
"The Reverend Mother will sit here, but you may rest yourself until she comes."
"I prefer to stand," Jessica said.
She watched the men unroll the carpets covering the ledge, looked out at the crowd. There were at least 10,000 people on the rock floor now, and still they came. Out on the desert, she knew, it already was red nightfall, but here in the cavern hall was perpetual twilight, a grey vastness thronged with people come to see her risk her life. A way was opened through the crowd to her right, and she saw Paul approaching, flanked by two small boys. There was a swaggering air of self-importance about the children. They kept hands on knives, scowled at the wall of people on either side.
"The sons of Jamis, who are now the sons of Usul," Stilgar said. "They take their escort duties seriously."
He ventured a smile at Jessica. Jessica recognized the effort to lighten her mood and was grateful for it, but could not take her mind from the danger that confronted her.
I have no choice but to do this, she thought. We must move swiftly if we're to secure our place among these Fremen.
Paul climbed up to the ledge, leaving the children below. He stopped in front of his mother, glanced at Stilgar, back to Jessica.
What is happening? I thought I was being summoned to council.
Stilgar raised a hand for silence, gestured to his left where another way had been opened in the throng. Chaney came down the lane, opened there, her elfin face set in lines of grief. She had removed her stillsuit and wore a graceful blue wraparound that exposed her thin arms. Near the shoulder on her left arm, a green kerchief had been tied.
Green for mourning, Paul thought.
It was one of the customs the two sons of Jamis had explained to him by indirection, telling him they wore no green because they accepted him as guardian father.
Are you the Lisan al-Ghaib?
They had asked, and Paul had sensed the jihad in their words, shrugging off the question with one of his own, learning then that Caliph, the elder of the two, was 10, and the natural son of Jeff. Orlop, the younger, was 8, the natural son of Jamis. It had been a strange day with these two standing guard over him, because he asked it, keeping away the curious, allowing him the time to nurse his thoughts and prescient memories, to plan a way to prevent the jihad. Now, standing beside his mother on the cavern ledge and looking out at the throng, he wondered if any plan could prevent the wild outpouring of fanatic legions. Chaney, near the ledge, was followed at a distance by 4 women carrying another woman in a litter. Jessica ignored Chaney's approach, focusing all her attention on the woman in the litter, a crone, a wrinkled and shriveled ancient thing in a black gown with hood thrown back to reveal the tight knot of grey hair and the stringy neck. The litter carriers deposited their burden gently on the ledge from below, and Chaney helped the old woman to her feet.
So this is their reverend mother, Jessica thought.
The old woman leaned heavily on Chaney as she hobbled toward Jessica, looking like a collection of sticks draped in the black robe. She stopped in front of Jessica, peered upward for a long moment before speaking in a husky whisper.
So, you're the one.
The old head nodded once precariously on the thin neck.
The Shadout Mapes was right to pity you.
Jessica spoke quickly, scornfully.
I need no one's pity.
That remains to be seen,
husked the old woman. She turned with surprising quickness and faced the throng.
Tell them, Stilgar.
Must I? He asked.
We are the people of Mysr,
the old woman rasped.
Since our Sunni ancestors fled from Nilotek al-Ruba, we have known flight and death. The young go on, that our people shall not die.
Stilgar took a deep breath, stepped forward 2 paces. Jessica felt the hush come over the crowded cavern, some 20,000 people now standing silently, almost without movement. It made her feel suddenly small and filled with caution.
Tonight we must leave this siege that has sheltered us for so long and go south into the desert,
Stilgar said. His voice boomed out across the uplifted faces, reverberating with the force given it by the acoustical horn behind the ledge. Still the throng remained silent.
The Reverend Mother tells me she cannot survive another Hajra, Stilgar said. We have lived before without a Reverend Mother, but it is not good for people to seek a new home in such straits.
Now the throng stirred, rippling with whispers and currents of disquiet.
That this may not come to pass, Stilgar said. Our new Sayadina Jessica of the Weirding has consented to enter the rite at this time. She will attempt to pass within, that we not lose the strength of our Reverend Mother.
Jessica of the Weirding, Jessica thought. She saw Paul staring at her, his eyes filled with questions, but his mouth held silent by all the strangeness around them. "If I die in the attempt, what will become of him?" Jessica asked herself. Again she felt the misgivings fill her mind. Cheney led the old Reverend Mother to a rock bench deep in the acoustical horn, returned to stand beside Stilgar.
"That we may not lose all if Jessica of the Weirding should fail," Stilgar said, "Cheney, daughter of Liet, will be consecrated in the Syadina at this time."
He stepped one pace to the side. From deep in the acoustical horn, the old woman's voice came out to them, an amplified whisper, harsh and penetrating.
"Cheney has returned from her Hajra. Cheney has seen the waters."
A susurrant response arose from the crowd.
"She has seen the waters."
"I consecrate the daughter of Liet in the Syadina,"
husked the old woman.
"She is accepted," the crowd responded.
Paul barely heard the ceremony, his attention still centered on what had been said of his mother.
If she should fail?
He turned and looked back at the one they called Reverend Mother, studying the dried crone features, the fathomless blue fixation of her eyes. She looked as though a breeze would blow her away, yet there was that about her which suggested she might stand untouched in the path of a Coriolis storm. She carried the same aura of power that he remembered from the Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam, who had tested him with agony in the way of the Gom Jabbar.
"I, the Reverend Mother Ramallo, whose voice speaks as a multitude, say this to you,"
the old woman said.
"It is fitting that Cheney enter the Syadina."
"It is fitting,"
the crowd responded. The old woman nodded, whispered,
"I give her the silver skies, the golden desert and its shining rocks, the green fields that will be. I give these to Syadina Cheney. And lest she forget that she's servant of us all, to her fall the menial tasks in this ceremony of the seed. Let it be as Shaihulud will have it."
She lifted a brown stick arm, dropped it. Jessica, feeling the ceremony close around her with a current that swept her beyond all turning back, glanced once at Paul's question-filled face, then prepared herself for the ordeal.
"Let the water masters come forward," Cheney said, with only the slightest quaver of uncertainty in her girl-child voice.
Now Jessica felt herself at the focus of danger, knowing its presence in the watchfulness of the throng, in the silence. A band of men made its way through a serpentine path opened in the crowd, moving up from the back in pairs. Each pair carried a small skin sack, perhaps twice the size of a human head. The sacks sloshed heavily. The two leaders deposited their load at Cheney's feet on the ledge and stepped back. Jessica looked at the sack, then at the men. They had their hoods thrown back, exposing long hair tied in a roll at the base of the neck. The black pits of their eyes stared back at her without wavering. A furry redolence of cinnamon arose from the sack, wafted across Jessica. "The spice?" she wondered.
"Is there water?" Cheney asked.
The watermaster on the left, a man with a purple scar line across the bridge of his nose, nodded once.
"There is water, Syadina," he said, "but we cannot drink of it."
"Is there seed?"
Cheney asked.
"There is seed," the man said.
Cheney knelt and put her hands to the sloshing sack.
"Blessed is the water and its seed."
There was familiarity to the rite, and Jessica looked back at the Reverend Mother Ramallo. The old woman's eyes were closed, and she sat hunched over as though asleep.
"Syadina Jessica,"
Cheney said. Jessica turned to see the girl staring up at her.
"Have you tasted the blessed water?"
Cheney asked. Before Jessica could answer, Cheney said,
"It is not possible that you have tasted the blessed water. You are outworlder and unprivileged."
A sigh passed through the crowd, a susurration of robes that made the nape hairs creep on Jessica's neck.
"The crop was large, and the maker has been destroyed,"
Cheney said. She began unfastening a coiled spout fixed to the top of the sloshing bag. Now Jessica felt the sense of danger boiling around her. She glanced at Paul, saw that he was caught up in the mystery of the ritual and had eyes only for Cheney.
"Has he seen this moment in time?"
Jessica wondered. She rested a hand on her abdomen, thinking of the unborn daughter there, asking herself, "Do I have the right to risk us both?" Cheney lifted the spout toward Jessica, said,
"Here is the water of life, the water that is greater than water can, the water that frees the soul. If you be a reverend mother, it opens the universe to you. Let Shai Hulud judge now."
Jessica felt herself torn between duty to her unborn child and duty to Paul. For Paul, she knew, she should take that spout and drink of the sack's contents. But as she bent to the proffered spout, her senses told her its peril. The stuff in the sack had a bitter smell, subtly akin to many poisons that she knew, but unlike them too.
"You must drink it now,"
Cheney said.
"There's no turning back,"
Jessica reminded herself. But nothing in all her Bene Gesserit training came into her mind to help her through this instant.
"What is it?"
Jessica asked herself.
"A liquor? A drug?"
She bent over the spout, smelling the esters of cinnamon, remembering then the drunkenness of Duncan Idaho.
"Spice liquor?"
she asked herself. She took the siphon tube in her mouth, pulled up only the most minuscule sip. It tasted of the spice, a faint bite acrid on the tongue. Cheney pressed down on the skin bag. A great gulp of the stuff surged into Jessica's mouth, and before she could help herself, she swallowed it, fighting to retain her calmness and dignity.
"To accept a little death is worse than death itself,"
Cheney said. She stared at Jessica, waiting. And Jessica stared back, still holding the spout in her mouth. She tasted the sack's contents in her nostrils, in the roof of her mouth, in her cheeks, in her eyes, a biting sweetness now.
"Cool."
Again, Cheney sent the liquid gushing into Jessica's mouth.
"Delicate."
Jessica studied Cheney's face, elfin features, seeing the traces of Lietkynes there as yet unfixed by time.
"This is a drug they feed me,"
Jessica told herself. But it was unlike any other drug of her experience, and Bene Gesserit training included the taste of many drugs. Janie's features were so clear, as though outlined in light.
"A drug."
Whirling silence settled around Jessica. Every fiber of her body accepted the fact that something profound had happened to it. She felt that she was a conscious mote, smaller than any subatomic particle, yet capable of motion and of sensing her surroundings. Like an abrupt revelation, the curtains whipped away, she realized she had become aware of a psychokinesthetic extension of herself. She was the mote, yet not the mote. The cavern remained around her. The people. She sensed them. Paul, Cheney, Stilgar, the Reverend Mother Amalu.
Reverend Mother?
At the school there had been rumors that some did not survive the Reverend Mother ordeal, that the drug took them. Jessica focused her attention on the Reverend Mother Amalu, aware now that all this was happening in a frozen instant of time, suspended time for her alone.
"Why is time suspended?"
she asked herself. She stared at the frozen expressions around her, seeing a dust mote above Cheney's head, stopped there, waiting. The answer to this instant came like an explosion in her consciousness. Her personal time was suspended to save her life. She focused on the psychokinesthetic extension of herself, looking within, and was confronted immediately with a cellular core, a pit of blackness from which she recoiled.
"That is the place where we cannot look,"
she thought. There is the place the Reverend Mothers are so reluctant to mention. The place where only Kwisatz Haderach may look. This realization returned a small measure of confidence, and again she ventured to focus on the psychokinesthetic extension, becoming a mote self that searched within her for danger. She found it within the drug she had swallowed. The stuff was dancing particles within her, its motions so rapid that even frozen time could not stop them. Dancing particles. She began recognizing familiar structures, atomic linkages, a carbon atom here, helical wavering, a glucose molecule. An entire chain of molecules confronted her, and she recognized a protein, a methyl protein configuration. Ah! It was a soundless mental sigh within her as she saw the nature of the poison. With her psychokinesthetic probing, she moved into it, shifted an oxygen mote, allowed another carbon mote to link, reattached a linkage of oxygen, hydrogen. The change spread, faster and faster as the catalyzed reaction opened its surface of contact. The suspension of time relaxed its hold upon her, and she sensed motion. The tube spout from the sac was touched to her mouth gently, collecting a drop of moisture. Cheney's taking the catalyst from my body to change the poison in that sack, Jessica thought. Why? Someone eased her to a sitting position. She saw the old Reverend Mother Amalo being brought to sit beside her on the carpeted ledge. A dry hand touched her neck. And there was another psychokinesthetic mote within her awareness. Jessica tried to reject it, but the mote swept closer, closer. They touched. It was like an ultimate simpatico, being two people at once. Not telepathy, but mutual awareness. With the old Reverend Mother. But Jessica saw that the Reverend Mother didn't think of herself as old. An image unfolded before the mutual mind's eye, a young girl with a dancing spirit and tender humor. Within the mutual awareness, the young girl spoke.
Yes, that is how I am.
Jessica could only accept the words, not respond to them.
You'll have it all soon, Jessica.
This is hallucination, Jessica told herself.
You know better than that. Swiftly now, do not fight me. There isn't much time. You should have told us you were pregnant.
Jessica found the voice that talked within the mutual awareness.
Why?
This changes both of you. Holy Mother, what have we done?
Jessica sensed a forced shift in the mutual awareness, saw another mote presence with the inward eye. The other mote darted wildly here, there, circling. It radiated pure terror.
You'll have to be strong. Be thankful it's a daughter you carry. This would have killed a male fetus. Now, carefully, gently, touch your daughter presence. Be your daughter presence. Absorb the fear. Soothe. Use your courage and your strength. Gently now. Gently.
The other whirling mote swept near, and Jessica compelled herself to touch it. Terror threatened to overwhelm her. She fought it the only way she knew. I shall not fear. Fear is the mind killer. The litany brought a semblance of calm. The other mote lay quiescent against her.
Words won't work, Jessica told herself.
She reduced herself to basic emotional reactions, radiated love, comfort, a warm snuggling of protection. The terror receded. Again, the presence of the old Reverend Mother asserted itself, but now there was a tripling of mutual awareness, two active and one that lay quietly absorbing.
Time compels me. I have much to give you, and I do not know if your daughter can accept all this while remaining sane. But it must be. The needs of the tribe are paramount.
What?
Remain silent and accept.
Experiences began to unroll before Jessica. It was like a lecture strip in a subliminal training projector at the Bene Gesserit school, but faster. Blindingly faster. Yet distinct. She knew each experience as it happened. There was a lover, virile, bearded, with the Fremen eyes, and Jessica saw his strength and tenderness, all of him in one blink moment, through the Reverend Mother's memory. There was no time now to think of what this might be doing to the daughter fetus, only time to accept and record. The experiences poured in on Jessica, birth, life, death, important matters and unimportant, an outpouring of single view time. Why should a fall of sand from a clifftop stick in the memory? She asked herself. Too late, Jessica saw what was happening. The old woman was dying, and in dying, pouring her experiences into Jessica's awareness as water is poured into a cup. The other moat faded back into pre-birth awareness as Jessica watched it. And, dying in conception, the old Reverend Mother left her life in Jessica's memory with one last sighing blur of words.
I've been a long time waiting for you. Here is my life.
There it was, encapsulated, all of it, even the moment of death. I am now a Reverend Mother, Jessica realized. And she knew, with a generalized awareness, that she had become, in truth, precisely what was meant by a Bene Gesserit Reverend Mother. The poison drug had transformed her. This wasn't exactly how they did it at the Bene Gesserit school, she knew. No one had ever introduced her to the mysteries of it, but she knew. The end result was the same. Jessica sensed the daughter mote still touching her inner awareness, probed it without response. A terrible sense of loneliness crept through Jessica in the realization of what had happened to her. She saw her own life as a pattern that had slowed, and all life around her speeded up so that the dancing interplay became clearer. The sensation of mote awareness faded slightly, its intensity easing as her body relaxed from the threat of the poison, but still she felt that other mote, touching it with a sense of guilt at what she had allowed to happen to it.
I did it, my poor, unformed, dear little daughter. I brought you into this universe and exposed your awareness to all its varieties without any defenses.
A tiny outflowing of love comfort, like a reflection of what she had poured into it, came from the other mote. Before Jessica could respond, she felt the adab presence of demanding memory. There was something that needed doing. She groped for it, realizing she was being impeded by a muzziness of the changed drug permeating her senses.
I could change that, she thought. I could take away the drug action and make it harmless.
But she sensed this would be an error.
I'm within a right of joining.
Then she knew what she had to do. Jessica opened her eyes, gestured to the water sack now being held above her by Chaney.
It has been blessed. Mingle the waters. Let the change come to all, that the people may partake and share in the blessing.
Let the catalyst do its work, she thought. Let the people drink of it and have their awareness of each other heightened for a while. The drug is safe now, now that a Reverend Mother has changed it.
Still, the demanding memory worked on her, thrusting. There was another thing she had to do, she realized, but the drug made it difficult to focus.
Ah, the old Reverend Mother.
I have met the Reverend Mother, Romalo. She is gone, but she remains. Let her memory be honored in the rite.
Now, where did I get those words?
Jessica wondered. And she realized they came from another memory, the life that had been given to her and now was part of herself. Something about that gift felt incomplete, though.
Let them have their orgy. They've little enough pleasure out of living. Yes, and you and I need this little time to become acquainted before I recede and pour out through your memories. Already, I feel myself being tied to bits of you. Ah, you've a mind filled with interesting things. So many things I'd never imagined.
And the memory mind encapsulated within her opened itself to Jessica, permitting a view down a wide corridor to other Reverend Mothers until there seemed no end to them. Jessica recoiled, fearing she would become lost in an ocean of oneness. Still, the corridor remained, revealing to Jessica that the Fremen culture was far older than she had suspected. There had been Fremen on Porotrin, she saw, a people grown soft with an easy planet, fair game for Imperial raiders to harvest and plant human colonies on Beleteguz and Salusa Secundus. Oh, the wailing Jessica sensed in that parting. Far down the corridor, an image voice screamed, "They denied us the Hajj!" Jessica saw the slave cribs on Beleteguz down that inner corridor, saw the weeding out and the selecting that spread men to Rossak and Harmonthap. Scenes of brutal ferocity opened to her like the petals of a terrible flower, and she saw the thread of the past carried by Sayedina after Sayedina, first by word of mouth hidden in the sand shanties, then refined through their own reverent mothers with the discovery of the poison drug on Rossak, and now developed to subtle strength on Arrakis in the discovery of the water of life. Far down the inner corridor, another voice screamed, "Never to forgive! Never to forget!" But Jessica's attention was focused on the revelation of the water of life, seeing its source, the liquid exhalation of a dying sandworm, a maker. And as she saw the killing of it in her new memory, she suppressed a gasp. The creature was drowned.
"Mother, are you all right?"
Paul's voice intruded on her, and Jessica struggled out of the inner awareness to stare up at him, conscious of duty to him but resenting his presence. "I'm like a person whose hands were kept numb, without sensation from the first moment of awareness, until one day the ability to feel is forced into them." The thought hung in her mind, an enclosing awareness. "And I say, look, I have no hands. But the people all around me say, what are hands?"
"Are you all right?"
"Yes."
"Is this all right for me to drink?"
He gestured to the sack in Chaina's hands.
"They want me to drink it."
She heard the hidden meaning in his words, realized he had detected the poison in the original unchanged substance that he was concerned for her. It occurred to Jessica then to wonder about the limits of Paul's prescience. His question revealed much to her.
"You may drink it. It has been changed."
And she looked beyond him to see Stilgar staring down at her, the dark, dark eyes studying.
"No, we know you cannot be false."
She sensed hidden meaning here, too, but the muzziness of the drug was overpowering her senses. How warm it was, and soothing. How beneficent these Fremen to bring her into the fold of such companionship. Paul saw the drug take hold of his mother. He searched his memory, the fixed past, the flux lines of the possible futures. It was like scanning through arrested instants of time, disconcerting to the lens of the inner eye. The fragments were difficult to understand when snatched out of the flux. This drug, he could assemble knowledge about it, understand what it was doing to his mother, but the knowledge lacked a natural rhythm, lacked a system of mutual reflection. He realized suddenly that it was one thing to see the past occupying the present, but the true test of prescience was to see the past in the future. Things persisted in not being what they seemed.
"Drink it."
Chaney waved the horn spout of a water sack under his nose. Paul straightened, staring at Chaney. He felt carnival excitement in the air. He knew what would happen if he drank this spice drug with its quintessence of the substance that brought the change onto him. He would return to the vision of pure time, of time become space. It would perch him on the dizzying summit and defy him to understand. From behind Chaney, Stilgar spoke.
"Drink it, lad. You delay the rite."
Paul listened to the crowd then, hearing the wildness in their voices. "Lisan al-Gaib," they said. "Muad'Dib." He looked down at his mother. She appeared peacefully asleep, in a sitting position, her breathing even and deep. A phrase out of the future that was his lonely past came into his mind. "She sleeps in the waters of life." Chaney tugged at his sleeve. Paul took the horn spout into his mouth, heard the people shout. He felt the liquid gush into his throat as Chaney pressed the sack, sensed giddiness in the fumes. Chaney removed the spout, handed the sack into hands that reached for it from the floor of the cavern, his eyes focused on her arm, the green band of mourning there. As she straightened, Chaney saw the direction of his gaze.
I can mourn him even in the happiness of the waters. This was something he gave us.
She put her hand into his, pulling him along the ledge.
We are alike in a thing, Usul. We have each lost a father to the Harkonnens.
Paul followed her. He felt that his head had been separated from his body and restored with odd connections. His legs were remote and rubbery. They entered a narrow side passage, its walls dimly lighted by spaced-out glow globes. Paul felt the drug beginning to have its unique effect on him, opening time like a flower. He found need to steady himself against Chaney as they turned through another shadowed tunnel. The mixture of whipcord and softness he felt beneath her robe stirred his blood. The sensation mingled with the work of the drug, folding future and past into the present, leaving him the thinnest margin of trinocular focus.
I know you, Chaney. We've sat upon a ledge above the sand while I soothed your fears. We've caressed in the dark of the CH. We've...
Paul found himself losing focus, tried to shake his head, stumbled. Chaney steadied him, led him through thick hangings into the yellow warmth of a private apartment, low tables, cushions, a sleeping pad beneath an orange spread. Paul grew aware that they had stopped, that Chaney stood facing him, and that her eyes betrayed a look of quiet terror.
You must tell me.
You are Sihaya, the desert spring.
When the tribe shares the water, we're together, all of us. We share. I can sense the others with me, but I'm afraid to share with you.
Why?
He tried to focus on her, but past and future were merging into the present, blurring her image. He saw her in countless ways and positions and settings.
There's something frightening in you. When I took you away from the others, I did it because I could feel what the others wanted. You press on people. You make us see things.
What do you see?
Paul had forced himself to speak distinctly. She looked down at her hands.
I see a child in my arms. It's our child, yours and mine.
Chaney put a hand to her mouth.
How can I know every feature of you?
They've a little of the talent, his mind told him, but they suppress it because it terrifies. In a moment of clarity, he saw how Chaney was trembling.
What is it you want to say?
Usul.
You cannot back into the future.
A profound compassion for her swept through him. He pulled her against him, stroked her head.
Chaney. Chaney, don't fear.
Usul, help me.
As she spoke, he felt the drug complete its work within him, ripping away the curtains to let him see the distant grey turmoil of his future.
You're so quiet.
He held himself poised in the awareness, seeing time stretch out in its weird dimension, delicately balanced yet whirling, narrow yet spread like a net, gathering countless worlds and forces, a tight wire that he must walk, yet a teeter-totter on which he balanced. On one side he could see the Imperium, a Harkonnen called Fade Rautha who flashed toward him like a deadly blade, the Sarduka raging off their planet to spread pogrom on Arrakis, the Guild conniving and plotting, the Bene Gesserit with their scheme of selective breeding. They lay massed like a thunderhead on his horizon, held back by no more than the Fremen and their Muad'Dib. The sleeping giant Fremen, poised for their wild crusade across the universe. Paul felt himself at the center, at the pivot, where the whole structure turned, walking a thin wire of peace with a measure of happiness, Chaney at his side. He could see it stretching ahead of him, a time of relative quiet in a hidden siege, a moment of peace between periods of violence.
There's no other place for peace.
Usul, you're crying. Usul, my strength. Do you give moisture to the dead? To who's dead?
To ones not yet dead.
Then let them have their time of life.
He sensed through the drug fog how right she was. Pulled her against him with savage pressure.
Sihaya!
She put a palm against his cheek.
I'm no longer afraid, Usul. Look at me. I see what you see when you hold me thus.
What do you see?
I see us giving love to each other in a time of quiet between storms. It's what we were meant to do.
The drug had him again, and he thought, so many times you've given me comfort and forgetfulness. He felt anew the hyper-illumination with its high-relief imagery of time, sensed his future becoming memories, the tender indignities of physical love, the sharing and communion of selves, the softness and the violence.
You're the strong one, Chaney. Stay with me.
Always.
And she kissed his cheek. Book 3. The Prophet.
No woman, no man, no child ever was deeply intimate with my father. The closest anyone ever came to casual camaraderie with the Padishah Emperor was the relationship offered by Count Hasmir Fenring, a companion from childhood. The measure of Count Fenring's friendship may be seen first in a positive thing. He allayed the Landsrod's suspicions after the Arrakis affair. It cost more than 1 billion solaris in spice bribes, so my mother said, and there were other gifts as well, slave women, royal honors, and tokens of rank. The second major evidence of the Count's friendship was negative. He refused to kill a man even though it was within his capabilities, and my father commanded it. I will relate this presently. Count Fenring, a profile by the Princess Irulan.
The Baron Vladimir Harkonnen raged down the corridor from his private apartments, flitting through patches of late afternoon sunlight that poured down from high windows. He bobbed and twisted in his suspensers with violent movements. Past the private kitchen he stormed, past the library, past the small reception room and into the servants' antechamber where the evening relaxation already had set in. The guard captain, Iokhan Nefud, squatted on a divan across the chamber, the stupor of Semuta dullness in his flat face, the eerie wailing of Semuta music around him. His own court sat near to do his bidding.
Nefud!
The baron roared. Men scrambled. Nefud stood, his face composed by the narcotic but with an overlay of paleness that told of his fear. The Semuta music had stopped.
My lord baron, Nefud said.
Only the drug kept the trembling out of his voice. The baron scanned the faces around him, seeing the looks of frantic quiet in them. He returned his attention to Nefud and spoke in a silken tone.
How long have you been my guard, captain Nefud?
Nefud swallowed. Since Arrakis, my lord. Almost 2 years.
And have you always anticipated dangers to my person?
Such has been my only desire, my lord.
Then where is Feyd Rotha?
The baron roared. Nefud recoiled.
My lord? You do not consider Feyd Rotha a danger to my person?
Again the voice was silken. Nefud wet his lips with his tongue. Some of the Semuta dullness left his eyes.
Feyd Rotha's in the slave quarters, my lord. With the women again, eh?
The baron trembled with the effort of suppressing anger.
Sire, it could be he's... Silence!
The baron advanced another step into the antechamber, noting how the men moved back, clearing a subtle space around Nefud, dissociating themselves from the object of wrath.
Did I not command you to know precisely where the Narbaran was at all times?
The baron asked. He moved a step closer.
Did I not say to you that you were to know precisely what the Narbaran was saying at all times? And to whom?
Another step.
Did I not say to you that you were to tell me whenever he went into the quarters of the slave women?
Nefud swallowed. Perspiration stood out on his forehead. The Baron held his voice flat, almost devoid of emphasis.
Did I not say these things to you?
Nefud nodded.
And did I not say to you that you were to check all slave boys sent to me, and that you were to do this yourself, personally?
Again Nefud nodded.
Did you, perchance, not see the blemish on the thigh of the one sent me this evening?
The Baron asked.
Is it possible, you—
Uncle!
The Baron whirled, stared at Fade Rautha standing in the doorway. The presence of his nephew here, now, the look of hurry that the young man could not quite conceal, all revealed much. Fade Rautha had his own spy system focused on the Baron.
There is a body in my chambers that I wish removed,
the Baron said, and he kept his hand at the projectile weapon beneath his robes, thankful that his shield was the best. Fade Rautha glanced at two guardsmen against the right wall, nodded. The two detached themselves, scurried out the door and down the hall toward the Baron's apartments.
Those two, eh?
The Baron thought.
Ah, this young monster has much to learn yet about conspiracy. I presume you left matters peaceful in the slave quarters, Fade?
The Baron said.
I've been playing Cheops with a slave master,
Fade Rautha said, and he thought, what has gone wrong? The boy we sent to my uncle has obviously been killed.
But he was perfect for the job. Even Howard couldn't have made a better choice. The boy was perfect.
Playing pyramid chess,
the Baron said.
How nice. Did you win?
Yes, Uncle.
And Fade Rautha strove to contain his disquiet. The Baron snapped his fingers.
Nefud, you wish to be restored to my good graces?
Sire, what have I done?
Nefud quavered.
That's unimportant now,
the Baron said.
Fade has beaten the slave master at Cheops. Did you hear that?
Yes, sire.
I wish you to take three men and go to the slave master,
the Baron said.
Garot, the slave master. Bring his body to me when you've finished, that I may see it was done properly. We cannot have such inept chess players in our employ.
Fade Rautha went pale, took a step forward.
But, Uncle, I—
Later, Fade,
the Baron said and waved a hand.
Later.
The two guards who had gone to the Baron's quarters for the slave boy's body staggered past the antechamber door with their load sagging between them, arms trailing. The Baron watched until they were out of sight. Nefud stepped up beside the Baron.
You wish me to kill the slave master now, my lord?
Now,
the Baron said.
And when you've finished, add those two who just passed to your list. I don't like the way they carried that body. One should do such things neatly.
I'll wish to see their carcasses, too.
Nefud said,
My lord, is it anything that I've—
Do as your master has ordered,
Fade Rautha said. And he thought, All I can hope for now is to save my own skin. Good, the Baron thought. He yet knows how to cut his losses. And the Baron smiled inwardly at himself, thinking, The lad knows, too, what will please me and be most apt to stay my wrath from falling on him. He knows I must preserve him. Who else do I have who could take the reins I must leave some day? I have no other as capable.
But he must learn, and I must preserve myself while he's learning.
Nefud signaled men to assist him, led them out the door.
Would you accompany me to my chambers, Fade?
The Baron asked.
I am yours to command,
Fade Rautha said. He bowed, thinking, I'm caught.
After you, the Baron said,
and he gestured to the door. Fade Rautha indicated his fear by only the barest hesitation. Have I failed utterly? He asked himself. Will he slip a poisoned blade into my back, slowly, through the shield? Does he have an alternative successor?
Let him experience this moment of terror, the Baron thought, as he walked along behind his nephew. He will succeed me, but at a time of my choosing. I'll not have him throwing away what I've built.
Fade Rautha tried not to walk too swiftly. He felt the skin crawling on his back, as though his body itself wondered when the blow could come. his muscles alternately tensed and relaxed.
"Have you heard the latest word from Arrakis?" the Baron asked.
"No, Uncle." Fade Rautha forced himself not to look back. He turned down the hall out of the servants' wing.
"They've a new prophet or religious leader of some kind among the Fremen," the Baron said. "They call him Muad'Dib. Very funny, really. It means the mouse. I've told Raban to let them have their religion. It'll keep them occupied."
"That's very interesting, Uncle," Fade Rautha said. He turned into the private corridor to his uncle's quarters, wondering, why does he talk about religion? Is it some subtle hint to me?
"Yes, isn't it?" the Baron said.